Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 27th, Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2007. We should have an interesting show coming up. We've got Maggie Hamilton, the author of What Men Don't Talk About, a new book that's out by Penguin, should be available in your local bookshop. And we also have, first up, Nick Gleason, who's a fascinating man. He's a father of two. He's been blind ever since he had a supermarket accident when he was the age of seven, and then he's an astonishing character. He runs marathons, climbs mountains, goes bungee jumping, all of which he says is to inspire his children to achieve whatever they want to achieve in life. Very inspirational character. Maggie is also very interesting. The book, What Men Don't Talk About, I'll just give you a couple of sentences from her introduction. She says, writing this book has been one of the most liberating yet at times shocking projects I have undertaken. It was prompted by my growing unease at the many assumptions I had made about men. While I'd been happy to believe that men's lives were easier than those of women, that men were never vulnerable, when I took a closer look at men, I began to realise this wasn't the case. It was only when I took a step back that I realised the many dilemmas men grappled with, the pain they felt, were largely invisible. And this shook me, she says. And it should be a very interesting interview.
This is really a book that every woman should read, isn't it?
Oh, it's a book I think everyone should read. It sounds it's a really good book, really interesting. Nice to see these sorts of books coming out instead of the blizzard of books on women's issues, often promoting the hatred of men as in the guise of social justice. Some other stories from around the world we'll take a quick look at before I go. This is from Cincinnati in Ohio. Customers at some suburban pizza parlors are getting some extra with their pepperoni and mushrooms. Wanted posters for parents accused of failing to pay child support. So
you're kidding.
This is shocking, isn't it?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
This is what the Germans did in with the Jews leading up to the war.
Yes, it's unbelievable.
It's awful. I mean,
if you think the child support agency's bad in Australia, try the Americans. The idea came to Cynthia Brown, executive director of the Butler County Child Enforcement Agency, while she was ordering pizza. It suddenly dawned on me that most people running from the law don't eat out. They order pizza, said Brown, whose country is north of county is north of Cincinnati. Enforcement agencies across the country use a variety of methods to locate support scoff laws, they call them, and collect past due payments. Virginia has issued subpoenas to cellular phone companies seeking addresses and phone numbers, while California's Tarrant County seizes and auctions parents' vehicles with proceeds going to the children. How are you going to get to work if you don't have a car, honestly? The state child support agencies collected more than $23 billion in child support in 2005, and it's a huge industry over there, and a very, very nasty industry indeed. Let's just hope they don't adopt some of these policies here. They certainly have been talking about trying to introduce these sorts of policies of cancelling your driver's licence and that sort of thing.
The problem is over there that the child support agency in the States actually gets a percentage of what they collect. So it's a revenue earning exercise for them as well. It's not so much...
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's money from the federal government goes into their coffers and into the state coffers. The more they get, the more they persecute the dads, the more money they make.
Yes.
It's an absolutely shocking system. Another story out of Spain here. The dean of Barcelona's judges, Maria Sanjusia, I can't possibly pronounce that.
That's near enough.
Fair enough. Has made some statements that are so reasonable that this is... From the misguided feminism, according to her, an aspired bloke called Juan Pablo Manueco. And he says she's made statements that are so reasonable that anyone can understand them, even without being a dean or simply a judge, in spite of the fact that these things may sound strange or new, given the constant media intoxication that is claiming the opposite. She says, the massive detention of men for scarcely any reason is a characteristic of totalitarian countries. The integral law on gender violence is causing a repugnant violation of fundamental rights in Spain. They've introduced all this new domestic violence legislation in Spain recently. And she says that it's provoked a sort of madness in the law that generates abuse. The elimination of the requirement of proof during the legal process and the absence of the presumption of innocence all of which in this recent state election, Morris Yemma, the Premier, was talking about introducing as well. So we need to watch out for this sort of stuff here as well.
More dad bashing.
She says affirmative action violates rights such as equality, the right of liberty and legal protection, or to effective judicial oversight. Another couple of quick stories in the world roundup before I go. The from the UK, this is on a site called politics.co.uk, and so the myth of absent fathers is a response to government consultation on the child support agency. And they write that just as history is written by the winners, the same is true when accounts are told of family breakdown. Given that in 93% of cases it is the mum who wins the children, certainly here it's even higher, I think 97%, and trending upwards are males paying child support to women, given that in 93% of cases it is the mum who wins the child in a family court lottery. It is hardly surprising that the myth has arisen of heroic single mums being abandoned by worthless dads. Such an important issue as the raising of our children is deserving of more careful analysis, and Labour politicians, and you could say this of here too, were happy to conceal the defects of the Child Support Agency, which have now been shut down, of course, by blaming absent fathers, trumpeting that two-thirds of them did not pay. It was only when investigative campaigners uncovered the true figures that the government acknowledged its error. Nevertheless, not letting the facts get in the way of a good story, politicians of all colours have continued to blame absent fathers for not supporting the children, when the true fault lay with the Child Support Agency, which was and still is hopelessly incompetent.
And the rest, dishonest, evil.
And the rest.
Yeah, they're
so
shockers.
True. Very unpopular institution here in Australia, and indeed right around the world.
Yeah. No, I don't think anyone's particularly got a child support agency anywhere that's doing a good job, I don't think. Not that I've heard of.
Certainly not very popular. And a final story here. It's a wild one. A Brazilian housewife was convicted and sentenced to 19 years in prison for killing her husband, chopping his corpse into small pieces and frying it. Rosanita Neri dos Santos, 52, was sentenced after a 15-member jury found her guilty of killing retired police officer Jose Raimundo Soares dos Santos. A spokesman said the killing occurred almost 2 years ago in a lower middle-class neighbourhood in the state capital of Salvador, northeast of Sao Paulo. The killing was either part of a black magic ritual or an attempt to get her hands on his life insurance money.
So, 19 years.
Killing her husband, chopping his corpse into small pieces and frying it.
And did she eat him? Did she eat him or just fried
well,
him?
Quite possibly. I'm next to a building site here. So
oh, you are indeed. Serious industry going on at your end of the world there.
Indeed. Good to talk to you guys. Have a great show.
So that's it, is it, John? Is that all we're going to get out of you this morning? All right, mate. Well, thanks for that. That's much appreciated. And you have a good morning over there in the Bahamas. I hope the weather's up to your normal standard.
Of course it is.
All right,
mate.
See
you later.
See you later.
Swallow your pride. all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. You just call brother, when you need a hand, we all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. If there is a load you have to that you can't carry, I'm right up the road, I'll share your load, if you just call me, if you need a friend.
There are many issues facing fathers and men in general today. Daily we struggle with being negatively stereotyped in the mainstream media. We see our homes, our children taken away from us when our relationships fail, and in the end we are left to pick up ourselves and move on. Most of us are successful in this, often due to being inspired by others who are seen to be even less fortunate than ourselves. If we think we do it hard, just imagine what it would be like to be a father who is blind. Someone whose enthusiasm inspires others to overcome many of life's difficulties. Joining us today is just such a person. His name is Nick Gleeson. Welcome to Dad's on the Air, Nick.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Nick, you've tried tandem skydiving, bungee jumping, scuba diving. You've run marathons and represented Australian athletic, goal ball and cricket. And now you've lost your sight when you were only 7 years old. How did all this start for you?
Well, it was, I suppose initially at the age of seven when I became blind, it was there was definitely an element of trauma involved and adjustment to that, and especially for my parents and I suppose for many, in particular fathers, they'd like to think of their children being the champions of whatever sport they play, and my dad was no exception. And all our children are champions in what they do, regardless whether they really are or not. But blindness, I think, was initially very confronting, but I was very fortunate that they allowed me the opportunity to get on with my life. They made adjustments and strategies, like putting bells inside a ball. They made sure that we still did things together. So in many ways, they treated me the same, except they just did things a little bit differently.
Can you remember anything? Do you have a memory of the visual aspects of that until you were seven? Can you remember the colours and shapes of things that might have helped you in later in life? Or?
I do remember colour, and I remember the colour of the sky and the cloud and looking at moonlight and the images of my parents, their facial features and all those things, which was important to me. Having said all of that, there, I have people that I know that are, who are born blind, and they've just got up and coped with what they have. And they've said to me, Nick, why do you have such a hang up about colour? Who cares what colour this is or that? Or and so that's their way of getting by and coping with life, really.
Yes. How about your school years, Nick? How did you cope with those?
School, I was assisted, obviously, through organisations like Vision Australia, who provided great assistance, and it was challenging because the last 4 years of my school was at a regular school, And in many ways, in those days, it sounds like a million years ago, but it wasn't that long ago, we didn't have the technology that we have today. So nowadays, a lot of information can be put onto the appropriate format through a computer, through computer systems, through Vision Australia. A lot of the material can be recorded far more quickly than in the past. So it was challenging, but again, it's just basically having that determination, commitment, discipline that really that my parents taught me, along with the organisations like Vision Australia that can actually build up the character of the person.
Nick, Vision Australia refers to you as their very own global adventurer. And apart from all the other achievements mentioned before, you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, Africa's highest peak. What was that like?
It was the most wonderful experience. And I suppose it's easy now that I'm sitting here on a chair and at sea level, and you sort of forget. It's probably a bit like a woman who's had it going through labour. Time seems to take away that pain, because it was difficult, and especially the last day or two when you're sort of reaching 6,000 metres and altitude starts to affect the body. But that opportunity to climb with three other people who were sighted and another chap who was blind, Charlie, and to experience the rainforest, where they described to us what the colours and the texture, and to stop and smell and listen to the stream, the beautiful streams and the wildlife, was magical. And also to, I suppose, to ultimately stand on the summit of Kilimanjaro was wonderful, and to listen to their description of how they could look across the plains of Africa and look down into the crater, and they described the blueness of the glacier. All those things were powerful descriptions that enabled a person who is blind to actually see.
It must have been fantastic. Nick, you're a father of two children. No doubt your family is also very proud of you. How do you manage the everyday parenting issues that we all face, but in your case it's a much more difficult one, would imagine?
Well, I suppose my role as father is I try to the best of my ability, and there are times when it doesn't quite work out the way that I hoped or should, to be an example to my children. They understand that I'm only a human being, so I have my frailties, but I try to set an example to them. I try to be as much involved and enjoy what they do. My son Peter is very sporting. I suppose he's a bit like me. I have a
chip of the old block.
Yeah, maybe. And he has a passion for that. So I thoroughly enjoy going to watch him. And notice I said watch, and I go to watch him play cricket and to play AFL. And he really, I mean, he would play any sport. Anything that moves or bounces, Peter loves.
Yes.
He would tackle anything. But even that was challenging in the sense that parents need, other parents found it a little bit initially difficult to understand my needs. So I remember the first year when Peter played cricket, and I'd go down with him by taxi, and I'd take my fold-up chair like most parents do, and I'd be sitting there all by myself, and no one would actually talk to me, and they didn't describe what was happening out in the field. So I had a chat with the manager, and we had a bit of a parent meeting. And once the parents actually understood that it was okay, that I really do appreciate them talking and describing things to me, and I didn't want to know everything. They didn't have to spend all day with me,
yes,
but just to be aware that it was important for me to know who was bowling and batting and the good shot Peter played or the bad shot that,
yes,
got him out. But there are things that often people just don't think of unless it's pointed out. And I suppose each and every individual, we all have our needs.
Yes.
It's a matter of sometimes speaking up and being a bit assertive and letting people know of our needs.
But it's often, probably a lot of times people don't understand what they feel they should be doing. They don't really know what to say or do, perhaps. And maybe they're... a bit worried about saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, you think?
Exactly. And that is often, that's resolved the more you actually get to know the person. So when you realise that Nick Gleeson is just like any other person, except you can't see, you can joke with me, you can say what you like, and I just want them basically to be themselves. There are certain things that I'd hope that they might pick up and realise that, okay, it's not as easy for me to negotiate or manoeuvre around an unfamiliar area or to know where people are. So it might be, Peter might say to me, Nick, did you want to come and join us over here, or did you want a coffee from the canteen?
Yes.
Or now let me know if you need any other needs. So, but that comes with confidence, and like you say, when people start to realise,
you're a normal human being.
Exactly, it becomes a lot easier.
And is your wife visually impaired as well?
She is. Heather is blind as well.
So together you must support each other a lot with raising the children, I guess. Or?
We did, and I suppose it's like any new parents, fathers, mothers, whoever. There's always an element of doubt or uncertainty.
Yes.
And we were no different. But we soon learnt that we had our own ways of coping, and we had safety things that we basically just followed, like all parents should do. For example, young children shouldn't be in the kitchen when preparing meals, because that would be most dangerous. We found that often people who are sighted actually don't follow the rules, and that's where accidents do occur, where we were more likely to be very stringent about that. And we avoided the accidents, touch wood.
So your children are actually your eyes at the moment?
Well, to a certain extent, although some people have said to me, so did you have children so that they could help you? And I said, no way. Now, for any parent, you know, if you want an easy, laid-back, lazy sort of type of life, you don't have children.
Don't have kids, exactly.
Exactly. But having said that, of course, with their development and growth, they have become very descriptive. So when we walk along the street, in particular, my son Peter will say to my wife, Mum, there's a beautiful flower there. It's because she loves flowers, and he'll describe the colour, and or might be a bird flying past.
She loves flowers, but she's never seen them. That's pretty...
Exactly. And they'll often stop, and where they can touch things, they'll touch that, or my daughter's very aware of things. So they're very aware children of our needs, but we are very conscious of not overburdening them with our needs either, because we've always wanted them to grow up to have a childhood just like any other child.
Yeah. Sure. How did you go when they were babies? Did you have any assistance? I mean, I can't imagine that, two blind people with a newborn baby. I mean, to me, that's I really can't understand how you could get through that.
Well, initially we weren't sure how that was going to work either. And being male, I think, and only generally speaking here, I have to admit that I was far more worried than what my wife was. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even sure about having children. I basically said no, and she said yes, and I said no, and of course it was yes, yes, we're two. We had a list of people that we could contact, because we thought, we might really need these people.
So you didn't have a live-in assistant or something?
No live-in people.
Right, okay.
But I think it's always nice to know, even though we didn't utilise the people that we had on our list of friends and family, it was still nice to have to know that they were there as a support.
Sure. But I just think, like, something really basic, like changing a nappy. I mean, you know, if you were blind, I think that would be really difficult to do, you know.
Well, again, my wife, I have to say, was much better than me, and I think I deliberately tried not to do it. I was usually...
Yes, but you wouldn't have seen the results, you see.
But my wife was very fantastic at doing that, and I think it was a matter of, Heather always says, it was a matter of... know how you use those baby wipes, so we probably use twice as many as the average person would.
Sure, but just making doubly sure.
Yeah, the end result was the same, a happy baby, and the reality is someone had to do it.
Yep.
It was our parenting role that it was part of it. So you learn to do it. And I always remember how my mother-in-law came over, and Heather was shocked that her mother, having had five children, had somehow lost the knack of putting nappies on properly. And she said, that is so ironic that after all those children, she, look at this nappy, it's so loose. Which made me really laugh.
Yeah. So how old are your kids now?
Belinda's now 15 and in year 10, and Peter is 11 and he starts high school next year.
We are speaking with Nick Gleeson, Vision Australia's very own global adventurer, who is also their community development coordinator. Nick, what does this role encompass?
It's a most enjoyable role in that it's very much involves the community. Over the years, I've been a presenter in the community, so have spoken to groups about vision loss, mostly to people who are sighted, and let them know about the services of Vision Australia, where they can go, or they can direct other people to receive services, and how they can support Vision Australia as members of the community, as well as a staff trainer. So nowadays I work with staff who have contact with people who are vision impaired or blind, which is always very rewarding. And I suppose in some respects it's spreading the word about the organisation of Vision Australia and what we do and how we do it.
Nick, we're almost out of time. You're a great ambassador for Vision Australia and a great inspiration to people facing difficulties. Just to sum up, what do you say to people generally when they face daunting difficulties in their life?
I really believe that, and we're all faced with daunting moments, and especially as parents or single parents and whatever we are faced with, it's a matter of seeing what is important and the goal and putting steps in place in order to achieve that goal. And the goal might be, which I think applies to all parents, is to be good parents, the best parents that we possibly can be. And by placing the steps in place, we can achieve that. We might stumble a few times along that journey, but it's important to get up and move on. And often the first step is the most difficult. And as parents, sometimes we have to do things that sometimes can be challenging, in that, you know, we've had a hard day at work, we go home, it happened to me yesterday, and my young son Peter wants to play at 7 o'clock at night, and I'm quite exhausted, but I stop and think, Nick, he's only 11 for a short time.
Yes.
Time is valuable. Make that effort. And I think, okay, I spend 15 minutes with him, and I felt so much better afterwards. He went away happy, I was happy, and I went to bed feeling content.
Nick, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
It certainly has.
You're a great inspiration, and it's been wonderful talking to you, and you're doing a great job. Don't retire yet.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be on air with you both.
Oh, thanks for coming on. That's
thanks,
great.
Nick. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, we're kind of back. We're half back. We're actually waiting for Maggie Hamilton to call in, who is going to be our next interviewee. She is the author of a book called What Men Don't Talk About. And I have here some notes from a keynote address entitled From Babies to Blokes that Maggie delivered to the Men's Advisory Network National Conference in October 2006. And she said, "Unless we look at the totality of men's lives from birth, we will never understand our men and boys, their issues, and how to fix them. This panoramic perspective is the approach I took with my book, What Men Don't Talk About, recently out, because as I spoke with men of all backgrounds, I kept coming up against more questions than answers. Finally, I decided to begin at the beginning of a man's life, in the womb, if I was to get the full picture. From here, I followed the life experience of baby boys through to manhood, then old age. Only then did many solutions to the many questions we all wrestle with become apparent. When I looked at the start of a boy's life, I was shocked to learn that generally more male embryos will be spontaneously miscarried than female embryos. More male babies will be born dead. This mortality pattern will follow the boys that survive through childhood, into adulthood, and for the rest of their lives. Few adults realize how tenuous a start to life many boys have because they see them as strong. This belief affects how a boy is treated from birth. As a result, they receive less cuddles, less attention, less interaction than baby girls do. This impacts in turn on how a little boy sees himself and the world. The messages he gets about whether he needs his needs get met and what is expected of him. Basically, our boys learn the harsh lessons of isolation and the need to be independent before they have the skills to cope with these things. Long before school, parents start to withdraw from their little boys, leaving boys feeling they are on their own in a whole range of areas. Basically, our boys are shut down, or as eminent psychologist Dan Kindlin points out, so begins the emotional miseducation of boys. This shutting down of our boys isn't something boys in our culture experience, but it does have many unforeseen and unfortunate outcomes for the lives of our boys and men and for those they interact with and those they love most. Again and again, when talking with me about problems they had to face, teen boys said there was no one who could help them. It was up to them to sort it out. This outlook doesn't make boys and men strong, it makes them vulnerable. Vulnerable in relationships, with their health, in their ability to navigate life's ups and downs, in old age, and in their enjoyment of life. I'm so glad the conference will be taking the microscope to the conditioning of our boys and to their development. We need to change the status quo. That's something that we here at Dads on the Air have been trumpeting from the rooftops for nearly 6 years now. Our men and boys are now operating in a highly sophisticated, fast-moving, ever-changing world. They need all the tools possible to let them navigate these changes, pick up on the nuances, and respond to them positively. The lives of women and girls have changed radically in the last few decades, but the way men and boys experience life has changed little from the lives of men and boys in previous generations. There are many details we need to pay attention to if we want to improve the lives of men and boys. The women's movement was and remains important. It had to happen. But as one psychologist pointed out, we have to be careful that we don't so attune our young men to women's needs that they have no sense of their own needs or how to fulfill them. This brings us to another central question: the transition from boyhood to manhood. One friend and fellow publisher, Rex Finch, who is very committed to men's concerns, took a group of at-risk boys out into the bush for a weekend with some Aboriginal tribal elders some time back. During their time together, the boys' issues began to emerge. Then one of the most at-risk boys broke down. "But what are men supposed to do?" he asked. How many hundreds, if not thousands, of boys are asking that same question? I'll repeat the question. But what are men supposed to do? All right, well, on the line now, we have Maggie Hamilton, all going well.
Are you there, Maggie?
I am indeed.
Hi. Welcome to Dads on the Air.
Good morning. Thank you. What a thrill to be with you.
How was that for a long introduction?
Fantastic.
Maggie, can I start you by asking what the motivation was for you to write the book, What Men Don't Talk About?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how books come to you, and this actually began, believe it or not, with a trip to the movies. A number of girlfriends had said to me, you must go and see the film The Hours, which was on a couple of years ago, that had people like Meryl Streep and other fantastic actresses in it, and actors as well. And all my girlfriends kind of prefaced their comments by saying, you love it, it's such a sad girl movie. You know, the women characters in the film are so tragic. And, of course, one thing that's quite irresistible to women is to be able to go and see a good sad movie, have a good cry, and then feel you're ready to get on with your life. So off I went with an elderly girlfriend, you know, kind of very much looking forward to this. And but what surprised me when I sat down to watch the film was that, yes, sure, the women's lives in the film were tragic, but so were the men's lives, equally tragic. And nobody seemed to, none of my girlfriends, who, you know, pretty open-minded, had got this. And when I came out of the movie, I found that other people who talked about it, other women at least, all talked about it in the same terms. And then a couple of months later, two long-term relationships of kind of a couple of decades fell apart, not acrimoniously, but I did what most women do. I kind of kept a close eye on the women in the relationship because, after all, women are the ones who are vulnerable and hurt, etc. And to my great horror, both men fell very badly apart. And I was so shocked by this, and I thought, you know, what is it that we're just not seeing in the lives of men? So I decided to, you know, talk to as many men as I could and write a book about it.
So how did you go about obtaining information for the subject matter of this book? After all, some would say see this as a secret men's business.
Absolutely. Well, looking back, it was a bit cheeky, I think, because I'm a very curious kind of person. I love to know kind of what's going on in people's heads, and I never assumed that men wouldn't talk to me. So I designed a very comprehensive questionnaire and set out to talk to literally dozens of men, young, old, from all different backgrounds. And to my great surprise and delight, the men were incredibly open. And I found that in interviewing them, I realized very quickly, I mean, A, they were surprised that women would be interested, which I found very sad that that's what we've kind of created. But also, what amazed me and moved me was that, and a number of men did cry when I interviewed them, was that they started to talk when they got to know me and trust me about things that clearly they had never talked to another human being about. Often really harrowing things or tragic things that their demeanor would never have betrayed. And alongside that, I did a lot of research into you know, kind of the latest psychological information, and also into popular culture to see how men are portrayed, and put all that together in the book. And there's 77 voices of men and boys in the book, and experts and bits from popular culture, from magazines, from books, etc., to try and give a picture of what is really going on in men's lives as opposed to what we assume are going on in men's lives.
So what are some of the stereotyping myths surrounding men and boys which you explode in this book, Maggie?
I think one of the central ones is that men don't feel as much as women feel, and that they're not as vulnerable as women can be. And that was a big surprise to me. What happened when I was interviewing the adult men is that, you know, although they were very honest, I kept feeling I wasn't getting to the answers to why, you know, women always rolling their eyes and saying, you know, men don't communicate, you know, they're emotional cripples, etc. And I went back to teenage boys and I still wasn't getting the answers, and back to little boys, and finally I start in the womb and I see how society actually shuts little boys down from very early, so that by the time these little boys have grown up to be men, they have, unlike little girls who are encouraged to chatter on and express everything they think and feel, grown men have the very clear message it's up to them to kind of do it on their own, and to see actually that is not the way men are, that is the way we socialise men to be.
So it's a cultural thing that...
I think it's definitely a cultural thing.
Because some other cultures don't have that sort of... They Absolutely. Value the male very highly, don't they?
They do, and also they allow men to be human. I mean, that might sound silly, but, you know, I was in Greece last year on holiday, and it was beautiful to see young men walking down the street, arm in arm, embracing each other without, you know, people rolling their eyes and, you know, making sexual assumptions. It's not that there's anything wrong with men being gay, but assuming that men cannot be close unless they're gay, to see them being very tender with elderly people, for instance.
And well, we have to put up with that being called our feminine side, so it's like we're trespassing into a female domain any time we show some sort of sensitivity.
Absolutely, and I think what happens with that when we shut our men down is that we all miss out. And I think that first and foremost, what I realised after spending, you know, two very intense years full time researching and putting the book together is that I'm so convinced now that there is so much more that joins us together than separates us. But the differences at their best are to be celebrated and encouraged.
So emotionally, you think there isn't that much between the sexes?
I don't, no. I think there is a different language for expressing that, and I think that's fine. But they did, there's a wonderful experiment which I mentioned towards the start of the book where they got little kids from 3 to 6 into a controlled environment, little boys and little girls, and the mum's jobs were to guess what the kids were thinking at the time. They were shown several visuals, some were funny, sad, etc. And the mothers had no difficulty guessing what the girls were up to because they could tell by their body language and the chattering and the expressions on their faces. Already on the little boys, it was almost impossible for these mothers to tell. And yet when they hooked the kids up to, you know, the kind of blood pressure and all those other indicators we have as to what's going on emotionally inside, they couldn't tell any difference between the boys and girls.
So is that saying that mothers are less sensitive to boys?
No.
Or that boys are conditioned to not express themselves as much as girls are?
That's
a bit of both, maybe?
Probably both. And I think that's very much the same for fathers as well. And I think there's a big message so that even though... And of course, our cues for our kids are their body language, their facial expressions, and what they say. Now, if we've already shut that down in little boys so young, then, you know, it means that parents are just not getting the right cues to when, you know, their boys might be distressed. And, of course, the extreme example of that is when, you know, we as happened to a dear friend of mine not that long ago, you know, they walked into the garage and their son was hanging from the rafters. He'd hung himself.
Yes.
And there is a definite progression there. And, you know, the kind of cutting edge of psychology is really recognising that now.
On Dad's on the Air this morning, we are talking to Maggie Hamilton, the author of What Men Don't Talk About. Maggie, the issues facing separated men today who have lost their homes and children, how is this affecting their emotional well-being?
I think it's... this is an area that really shocked me, I have to say, when I... Because I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I always thought that men just coped and that, you know, they weren't vulnerable, etc. But to see, having spent time around these men, it was an intensely moving and often harrowing experience to see, you know, men who said that no matter what happened, no matter what they achieved in life, it would never make up for the loss of the children in their lives, even if they have access once a fortnight. And I think this is something we just don't get, although I think we're starting to get this, is how much men ache for their children, and that we caught up in the stereotype of, you know, the guy who's got heaps of money and is, you know, driving around in a red Porsche with a busty blonde, when in fact the reality is how impoverished so many men are, materially impoverished and certainly emotionally impoverished. I mean, I remember one incredibly sad story of one guy I interviewed where there was so little to come and go on, but he would wash his children's clothes every night so that when they were staying with him, so that they'd have the dignity of clean clothes every day. And, you know, I heard hundreds of stories like that. The other side of that I think we forget is that because I go into the developmental aspects of our little boys and girls, that when they do not have a father around or a father figure or father figures, how deprived they are developmentally of this, that there are very, very strong reasons why nature has a mother and a father, because each gives very different kind of gifts to their children.
Yes.
To help prepare them for life, and that is something I think we're only starting to realise now.
Yeah, it's also a lot of men don't appreciate how deep their feelings are going to be until they go through something like a family breakup. I mean, I know myself, I'd never, ever experienced emotions anything like what I experienced when my family broke up, and I went through 2 years of depression that were absolutely unprecedented in my life. I had never encountered feelings of that magnitude and depth before, and had no real technology or no real means of dealing with it at all. I basically just locked myself away and wrote books, you know.
Yes, and I think this is just so common. And what my hope is that more and more men and fathers, but also men with a whole range of experiences, will start to come forward and let's see those articles in magazines, let's see those programs on TV. And I think that the difficulty often, because again of the way we bring our boys up, is that men retreat because they feel ashamed and bewildered and isolated because of the way they're brought up. But, you know, people, I think society in general, I've found with the book that, because it's now been sold to a number of other countries, which is just wonderful.
Yeah, well done. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, there's been a great need for a book like this for a long time, I think.
Thank you. I'm amazed at the response from men and women of all ages and backgrounds, you know, from very young women to elderly men, elderly women, yes, etc. And they've all said to me, you know, even if they've had quite strong views, opposing views in the past, if only I had understood this 20 years ago. So I think there is a real importance for what I would say to anybody who's listening is that, you know, if you have friends who are journalists, tell your story.
Yes.
Let's get those articles, because
unless we
give the stories, these stereotypes have only come about, I think, because we haven't had the voices. We haven't had the stories. I don't think there's some terrible plot.
No, it just seems that men have been left behind. Women have gone through a great sociological change in the last 50 years. Women have changed. And men have pretty much been left behind. We're still kind of thinking the old, same old, you know, 15th century, you know, nuclear family idea, which women seem to have moved away from.
That's absolutely right, but it's interesting because my new book's on women and it's a very different slant, and what I'm seeing is the ache for a good man. And this is something that I think women aren't talking about, is that in the brave new world of careers and everything else, which are valid and important for those who want that, but what I'm finding with the younger women is the anger and the loneliness, because, you know, they were brought up to believe that could supplant the very human need for the warmth of another human being in their life.
Yes, we've dreamed all this kind of nonsense up over the last 50 years, and we're trying to reprogram ourselves, both sexes, and we're programming ourselves apart. It doesn't seem to be a positive side to it.
And this is why I'm very excited about this new book, because I'm looking at the parts of young women's lives that are not working, and it's really quite harrowing from teenage girls up. And I'm quite excited about it, because I think when you put the two lots of research together, it comes back to the fact that basically we're all human beings, and that as human beings we want three things. We want to be loved, we want to be acknowledged, and we want to belong. And I think the questions moving forward for us is, how do we create that human warmth of belonging, of being acknowledged and loved? And these are very essential human things. And then how do we encourage a male language? If I could just briefly tell you a very powerful thing that happened to me is the book was finishing.
Please do.
My 14-year-old nephew, who was a brilliant young athlete, much to the surprise of the whole family, because none of us are, was preparing for the New Zealand Cycling national championships, and a lady was driving along in the car and wasn't paying attention, and even though he's in the right lane, she lost control, and basically he was hit and killed almost instantly.
Oh, tragic.
Went to the funeral, and two amazing things happened there. One was that the chaplain of the local hospital ran the service and said, "We're here not only to honour Matt, but to express our pain, men, women, boys and girls." And because of that, grown men got up in that service and they wept openly. It was one of the most powerful things a woman could experience. At the end of the service, when Matt was put in the hearse and it was time for him to be driven off, the young boy who had the harrowing thing of being there and seeing everything, because he was also training with Matt, came out in front of the hearse with about five other boys, and they were all brilliant athletes. And they all started to dance the Māori haka. None of these boys were Māori. But they had been given a male language to express in that moment how they felt. I cannot tell you how moving. No, there wasn't a dry eye. Didn't matter how young or how old.
No, I'm starting to mist up just hearing about it.
Can you feel the power of that? Every movement spoke those boys' pain, bewilderment, helplessness, sorrow beyond anything that words could give. And suddenly in that moment I thought, my God, this is what it's about. It's not about men becoming
versus
women.
No.
It's about men finding their own language to
What's happened to men's language? We must have had one. Or do you think we never had one? You know, where's it gone?
I think what has happened to men in the West, I mean, obviously that comes from an indigenous group who still culture that has
strong
kept that
culture.
Alive,
yep.
Strong culture alive. And I think we need to find new forms of that. And then what we as women need to do is we need to learn to walk across the bridge and to understand the nuances of that language so that we understand, just as men have come a long way, I think, to understanding women's language, because there's a very interesting psychologist, Tannenbaum, who you may know. He makes a really interesting and valid point, which hit me between the eyes. And he said, one of the difficulties with a lot of our young men growing up today is they have the women's language, they know women's needs. But unless they understand their own needs and how to satisfy it, we are growing young men up to put them in a very psychologically vulnerable situation for adulthood.
Maggie, you worked for some time in the Office for the Status of Women, which is part of the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. Policy recommendations are formulated there which have the potential to impact badly on men. Do you think in hindsight that there was much real understanding by those working there of what Australian men face today in our modern society?
I was actually on one of the committees for the Office. I didn't actually work in the committee. It was a history project on women's lives. So I can't speak to the intimacies of the Office, but what I am finding with a lot of my friends who've had jobs that have had major influence in various areas is that there is a certain sorrow there, I think, now, and a definite softening, because they didn't understand the nuances. And I think this is what happens when we have huge social change very quickly. We don't know where it's leading us. And this is what I'm looking at in the lives of young girls and women, because in fact there are some very dark things that are happening with the cutting and the sexually transmitted diseases and alcoholism and drug addiction that we're not talking about. And so I think there is no doubt that there are things that have impacted badly on the lives of men, and I don't think that that was a deliberate thing. I think it was because we were stepping in new territory as we continue to. What I would say to all the wonderful men in Australia is that it is time for us to honour what you have built to create a safe society for us. And I look particularly in the book at in one section about all the jobs men, we go on about the glass ceiling, but we don't look at the jobs that men do that keep us safe, that kind of really build the fabric of society. But also I think men need to get that message out about themselves, and they need to find ways to honour each other that is not competitive, that is not isolating, that is not just about being the sports hero. And I think we need to find ways to do that, to also to really support our young fathers. They're doing a fantastic job without support. The way they're embracing the love of their children, nurture. And we need to find a way, and I think it has to come from the men, that boys at school, whether they're a mathematician, an artist, a dancer, that as in Europe, those men are, those young boys are valued and honoured for what they're going to be. They're not just the sports hero. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but boys need to understand there are hundreds of thousands of ways to be a good and valued man.
So we've got a lot of work to do.
A lot of work to do. And a lot of wonderful work. I think it's quite exciting because, as I say, the immense, I really, you know, because a lot of the men actually said to me when I was writing the book, you know, you're going to be absolutely hung, drawn and quartered. Quite the opposite has happened. And it is the stories that have spoken to people's hearts and have got them out of their heads and the theories they have about this, that and the other into the human experience. And I think that's the way forward for guys.
Maggie, we're nearly out of time. We'd like to thank you for joining us. And we certainly wish you lots of luck with the book. Is the book available? Is it available?
It's available. It's available in all bookstores. And if they've run out, they can easily order the copies then.
And the book is called What Men Don't Talk About by Maggie Hamilton, published by Penguin and Viking. Maggie, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Maggie.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful.
Your input was excellent.
And keep putting the word out there because it's people like you that will change the way we think about.
Yeah, thank you for caring about
men.
Us blokes.
Oh,
we need more women like you to be sensitive to our needs that we're all pretending we don't have.
I just want to say thank you to all the good men who give us the society we have. And I want to say thank you for all the men who shared the most deeply painful parts and the happy parts of their lives as well. It has changed my life. And I know from the emails I've received it has changed a lot of other people. So thank you.
Maggie Hamilton, you're an inspiration.
Thank you, Maggie.
Bye now.
Bye. We're dads on the air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions.